Greetings this morning in the name of our Lord. I realized at the end of these announcements that I should probably make one of my own, that just invite your prayers. Tomorrow and Tuesday, I'll be meeting with a committee the Viewpoint Committee. Some of you know about Viewpoint. It's a group of men that are devoting some time to not so much to write the papers as to provide authors, people who will write. We have several good authors. I should just mention the men who are on the committee. It's Stephen Brubaker, John Koblenz, Matt Landis, Gary Miller, Merle Burkholder, and myself. And I admit that I feel a little out of league with those men, but they've invited me to serve, and so I do. Not all of our work is seen equally important by people, and so we sometimes struggle with knowing for sure how best to move forward. And so invite your prayers as we look to the future. I have last Sunday, being our first Sunday back from El Salvador, thought I would give a brief report at share time about our time in El Salvador, and time didn't permit that, and it barely does today, but with my age, I think it's better if I do something while it's a little fresher on my mind than if I wait much longer. And so I'm going to take just a very brief time, I hope, here before my message to give you a brief report. I am currently serving as the El Salvador rep. Sorry, I need to quit blowing so hard. I'm responsible for recruiting people to serve in El Salvador, and that includes then just taking more of an interest in the work that is happening. And so it seemed important to the board and to me that we spend some time there in sort of a pastoral role. We stayed in the little town of Las Delicias, where John and Anita had been for a time, and where Christopher and Rachel had as well. Not too far from Respaldadero, where Jenna and Marietta served for many years. And the little church there has met some challenges that just simply require some attention. And so we were privileged to be there. And to tell you that we got everything fixed would be a stretch. But these things have to happen organically as well. And so The Lord provided many opportunities and is continuing to provide opportunities for interaction that we trust can bring fruit. The work in El Salvador is gradually returning more and more of that over to the national brothers, and so there is that process ongoing. We just trying to determine which things I should be looking at. One of the things that had happened because of the church having, because of the mission having started very small and grown to something quite a bit bigger. Now it started out as what I'm going to call more of a conference. There was pretty much they operated together. They moved together. The decisions they made were made together. The 10 or 15 churches that are there would move together on decisions they made. The time has come where they're dissolving that I'm going to call it conference, and are becoming more and more congregational. And so it has its challenges to move from one to the other. Now, one reason being that's how we operate, and as a Beachy constituency, and so it seemed reasonable that at some point that happens there as well. So invite your prayers as the work moves forward there. We were there during Holy Week, and that is still a recognized and a respected week. Many of the offices are closed, don't get much legal work done during that week. Here we barely even notice Good Friday anymore, whereas there that becomes a pretty important, that's an important day yet for the Salvadoran culture, especially the Catholic churches, and or I should say the Catholic Church. There are different festivals, different things that they do during that week that are their effort at commemorating and remembering the sufferings of Christ. And not all of them make an equal amount not all of them I understand logically very well, I have to admit. There are things they do that don't make much sense to me, but then there are things they do that they feel are is an evidence of how the gospel works, how Christ works, and so forth. One of those festivals occurs. It's the only one I think in the world that I'm aware of, in the little town of Texas Tepeque, in El Salvador. I mean, it's a town where you have a mission, and it happens the day after Palm Sunday, where the and I think in this case, the pictures I saw, and by the way, I just offer I have an article I'd be glad to forward to anybody that would like to see it. The pictures that I saw included about a dozen men or so who dress up like demons. And they call them Dalciguinis. Is that pronounced right, Arthur? I mean, maybe you're not. Okay. Anyhow. Well, we happened to be there, not at the town. We just heard of it afterward, how the town was just literally plugged with people who come from all over El Salvador to be a part of this festival. But these men who are armed with whips, and they run throughout the town whipping people. Now, sort of playfully, and yet it's an effort to bring people to redemption is the idea. It represents bringing people, disciplining people, and bringing them to redemption is the way I understand it. At the end of the festival, these men then lie on the ground, and a man who is costumed like Jesus, supposedly, steps over these men and takes authority over the demons. Again, it's their way in this town of commemorating the suffering of the Lord, and it's their way of offering the gospel. Well, I say offering the gospel. At least it's an effort to call attention to the gospel. It's some of those things, though, that evangelical Christianity has come to El Salvador and is changing. There is an amazing number. There are an amazing number of churches, evangelical churches anymore in El Salvador. Compare that to its beginning, where we were not allowed to proselytize at all. We were not to present the gospel from our perspective back in the 60s, but that has changed greatly. We started the work there, or I should say they, AMA started the work there in the early 60s, and we started with ag projects. Very recently, when Ronald and Brenda were visiting there, they went to a market in a town called Takachico, which is just about 10 miles south of the village where Floyd Miller is buried. And beside one of the vendors, there was or someone they were doing business with, they saw someone else that was selling chickens. And so Ronald engaged him in conversation and asked about, do you grow your own chickens? Oh, yes, we do. He said, the Mennonites taught us how to grow them. And that was 40, 50, 60 years ago now. And they actually dropped the names of the men who were a part of the mission back then. So it is interesting to see the contact how that blessed the people there. And of course, throughout the years, we have had different ministries. And one that touched the most lives was the clinic at El Espaladero, where Jana and Marietta and others served. I mentioned last Sunday that we have that the clinic is going to be revived, not under our mission, but under another mission, and so we are indeed very grateful for that. There's a project going on that I would like to, if there would be some interest at some point, for a group of men to go help. We'd like to arrange for that. The churches, the Mennonite churches there in El Salvador, are putting up a facility that will be able to accommodate up to 600 people in the auditorium, and it's a lot of work is falling on a few people, and if we could put together a work team that could go to help, we would like to do that at some point. And so if someone has an interest, let me know, and if things come together, I maybe bring it up again. The place is called Manantial. It's located in the at about, I think, around 3,500 feet or so. So it's a very pleasant atmosphere. It was cool, and it's very different than Las Delicias in Texas Tepeque. Someone asked while we were down there, why did the Mennonites put churches in all the hot areas of El Salvador? I wonder too. But I wondered that while we were down there. I should just say this, that the churches are putting together a document of expected minimums that would touch each congregation, but they're, as they move towards something congregational, more of a congregational governance, they are still providing a document that helps to keep them in touch with each other and connecting with each other. Well, I need to move on to what we're really here for this morning. Brother Mark mentioned that there are several things about this time of year that we celebrate, and I really did enjoy hearing school experiences. Mark, your testimony was powerful, and just a reminder to those of us who lead that caring for people is ultimately very, very important, and how Mr. Mullet blessed you and you have blessed us is certainly a gift. I'd like to, however, turn my attention to the other subject, that of Mother's Day. I don't know how the ladies find Mother's Day messages, because if I go to Proverbs 31 and I talk about the ideal person, the ideal woman, the ideal wife, the ideal mother, sometimes people, I have learned, can feel a little discouraged or a little like, how do we get there? Or who is that you're talking about? And I've decided instead of I'll go to Proverbs 31 yet at the end, but I'd like to this morning look at one attribute that is especially common for the gender that sits on my left here. And it's the attribute that I think is probably most noted. There are just a variety of stories in the Old Testament particularly of how this attribute showed itself. But before I do that, I'd like to just acknowledge that there are all of you here, that is of the sisters of the female gender, are at different points in life. I say at different points. Some of you are similar, but when I think of mothers, when I think of women in general, and how God has graced this world with the tender gender, it is a huge gift that we, as the rest of us who are not wired quite that way, are blessed by. But all of you also are going to find yourself at different places. And so there's some here who were never married, who were never a mother, who will never be a mother. There are those who have been married but have not experienced motherhood as we know it. They haven't had children. There are those who are married and have maybe one or two children and would really like to have more. There are others who have a quiver full of them and probably feel a little overloaded sometimes and overwhelmed. There's others who've had children but grieve over the choices that children have made and stay awake at night instead of changing diapers, praying for those who have made bad choices. There's just a lot of ways that we as parents, that you as ladies, greet life, walk life, and live life to the glory of God. And I'm going to move to the one attribute that I think is especially remarkable for you as women that I would identify. And that one has to do with caring, for the way that you care for people, for the way you care for your family, for the way that you care for for your children. Every person here has a mother. In fact, every soul that has walked the earth, except for Adam and Eve, has had a mother. And so much, we owe so much to our mothers who gave us birth and who are endowed with a deeply caring instinct for their offspring. And not necessarily just their offspring, but for the offspring that they have perhaps nurtured. I just happened to see my sister Rosa here who nurtured at least you had the chance to nurture 70 of them, right, as they passed through your home in foster care. Who here has not nurtured and does not have the heart of nurture? And so I just bless God for the way that you as ladies, you as women, nurture people, nurture children, nurture your children, nurture other people's children. Now, fathers, according to the scriptures, also pity their children. At least Psalm 103 says, as a father pitieth his children, so the Lord pitieth them that fear him. I believe God pities as well as a mother does. Even though we call him father, I believe he is capable of the emotion that you as women have toward the needs of people around you. And so he at least grants that we men do some of it. And that is true. When I look at a child of one of my children that was suffering, that was hurting, there's something that wells up inside. But I think it's yet a little different for me than it was for my wife. I think you'll forgive me if I use the word instinct. I know that sounds like it comes from somewhere else besides God, but God gave us those too. But he has given, I believe, our wives, our mothers, the women in our lives, a caring heart that is unmatched by how we men care. Although God is omnipotent, well, may I say, because he is omnipotent, he can care as well as you can, and even better. There are six instances in the Bible that I'd like to lift out of how women cared for their own. And some of them bring tears, bring grief, bring just a sense of, I'm not quite sure what to call it. And you'll learn, you'll understand as I mention them. In Isaiah 49, there's a rhetorical question that Isaiah asks. He says, "Can a mother forget her nursing child?" Now, the context is Israel. The context is that and God's care, God's love for Israel, and the answer to that question he answers it just by the fact that he's the omnipotent God. God does not forget. God does care. God cares very deeply for his people. And in Genesis chapter 2, Genesis 21, verse 16, we have the story of Hagar. And I would like to just read some of these very quickly. We can't spend a lot of time in them, but I would like to look at some of these because it demonstrates the heart of the mother. In 21 verse 16, it says this about Hagar. Remember that her son Ishmael looked like he would die. In verse 15, it says, "And the water was spent in the bottle, and she cast the child under one of the shrubs. And she went and sat her down over against him a good way off, as if it were a bow shot. For she said, 'Let me not see the death of the child.' And she sat over against him and lifted up her voice and wept." Now, you might say, how does that demonstrate care? Maybe it doesn't demonstrate care so much as it does just a heart of grief to see what her child was experiencing. And yet it's because she cared for Ishmael that she just had to distance herself from the grief that she saw, and she just did not want to see him die. And so we ask, so how does that demonstrate care? I think she was more dealing with the emotion of disappointment, of rejection. Remember, she had just been run off from what was her home and asked to leave, and now this. And it was a very hard time. Of course, the Lord then spoke to her and brought her comfort. And the angel of the Lord of God called to Hagar out of heaven and said unto her, "What aileth thee, Hagar? Fear not, for God hath heard the voice of the lad where he is. Arise, lift up the lad, and hold him in thine hand, for I will make him a great nation." And God opened her eyes, and She saw a well of water. She went, filled the bottle with water, and gave the lad drink. This is the first example. The second example we find in Exodus chapter 2. The story of Jochebed. She's not named in this passage, but elsewhere, it is Amram and Jochebed were the parents of Moses. And in the way that she demonstrated her care, first off, was she kept him around longer than she should have, according to the edict from Pharaoh. But in Exodus chapter 2, verse 3, it says, "And when she could no longer hide him, she took for him an ark of bulrushes and daubed it with slime and with pitch and put the child therein, and she laid it in the flags by the river's brink." And of course, you know the story about how Miriam watched, and then Pharaoh's daughter came, and Miriam offered someone that could nurse the baby, and so it was Amram's way of providing for this little soul. You wouldn't think that care looks that looks much like care to put him in a basket and put him out in a pond, but it was the thing she had to do. She felt like to protect her child. Of course, the rest of the story is we know the rest of the story. In 2 Samuel 21, we have a most heart-wrenching story of a mother that took care of her sons that had been slain. In 2 Samuel 21, verse 10, the background is simply that there was that King David was trying to bring justice to the Gibeonites, or for the Gibeonites, because of what Saul had done to them. And the Gibeonites had asked that seven men of Saul's family be killed, and that they be given the carcasses. It would be a corpse, I guess. But anyhow, they would be given the dead. Or then they would slay them. Now I'm getting that mixed up a bit. But in verse 10, here's the mother of two of these men. "And Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah, took sackcloth and spread it for her upon the rock from the beginning of harvest until water dropped upon them out of heaven, and suffered neither the birds of the air to rest on them by day, nor the beasts of the field by night." You know, it's the kind of thing that just makes you grieve to think of this woman that stayed out there 24/7 on a rock. It says she at least had a burlap bag, the way it sounds, or some kind of a sackcloth, and laid it on the rock to give herself a little bit of comfort while she kept running the birds off, the birds and the beasts off. A mother's care. And then in 1 Kings chapter 3, I think I will not turn to that. We'll just relate the story. It's the story of two women that came to King Solomon. And they both had a child. And the one child died. And there was a disagreement as to whose child this was. And so Solomon, in order to establish who the mother really was, he told a guard to cut the child in half, and the mother who was claiming that, well, they were both claiming the child, but the one who was not the mother said, "Sure, go ahead and do that. That's fine. We each get a little bit that way." And the other one said, "No, I'd rather see this child adopted to that woman that I dislike than to lose it." And of course, Solomon, being the wise man he was, discerned. And it brought, for Solomon, it was it was one of those moments where the people recognized that this is a wise man. He has a way of determining the truth. And of course, we look at that story, we can hardly imagine the drama that went on, and especially how that mother must have felt as she offered her child up for adoption. I know I'm adding that, but basically that's what it was. I'd rather have her have the child than to have the child killed. Solomon indeed showed his wisdom there. And then there's a woman in Shunem. You remember that she had built Elisha, a little room that was not, that he would not have needed to, that she did out of the goodness of her heart, that they built a room for him. And then he prophesied that she would have a son. And she did. But later, as his son grew, he was in the field with his father, and the father and the father sent him home because he had a headache, or someone took him home, maybe. But there it says that the mother held him in 2 Kings 4:25. The mother held him on her lap until noon, till he died. Again, just the care, the love that this woman demonstrated. And of course, the Lord provided that the young lad was raised again, and that is a story in itself that I can't, we don't have time for. And then in the New Testament, I'll lift out one example. That is the Canaanite woman in Matthew 15:22. And I admit that my understanding of that the way Jesus approached that may not seem like it was caring, but it was his way of, I think, it was his way of bringing the truth out, of seeing how desperate this woman was. In Matthew 15:22, we have the story of this of the Canaanite woman who brought her daughter, and she said, "I have mercy on me, O Lord, thou son of David. My daughter is grievously vexed with the devil." But he answered her not a word. And his disciples came and besought him, saying, "Send her away, for she crieth after us." But he answered and said, "I am not sent but to the lost sheep of the house of Israel." Then came she and worshipped him, saying, "Lord, help me." But he answered her and said, "It is not meet to take the children's bread and cast it to the dogs." And she said, "Truth, Lord, yet the dogs eat of the crumbs which fall from the master's table." Jesus then answered and said unto her, "O woman, great is thy faith. Be it unto thee even as thou wilt." This was a woman who cared for her child and desperately wanted this child to live and to be delivered of these demonic spirits. And for whatever reason, Jesus tested her. But her perseverance was the evidence of her care in this case. Turn with me, if you would, to now to 1 Samuel chapter 1. We have a beautiful story there. Again, I'm going to need to limit my comments, but there are things there that I think we ought to notice. I'm going to read part of it. It's the story of Samuel. Beginning in verse 4, this is 1 Samuel chapter 1, beginning in verse 4, maybe I should have given a little bit of background here. This man, Elkanah, had two wives, and they would go yearly to worship at Jerusalem. Wait a minute, was it Jerusalem? I'm sorry, I said it wrong. Pardon me? Shiloh, thank you. Later it was Jerusalem where they went to. But they came to Shiloh where Eli was priest along with his sons. And this man would bring both of his wives along. In verse 4, then it says, when the time was that Elkanah offered, he gave to Peninnah his wife, and to all her sons and daughters portions. But unto Hannah he gave a worthy portion, for he loved Hannah, but the Lord had shut up her womb. And her adversary also provoked her sore, for to make her fret, because the Lord had shut up her womb. And as he did so year by year, when she went up to the house of the Lord, so she provoked her. Therefore she wept and did not eat. Then said Elkanah her husband to her, Hannah, why weepest thou, and why eatest thou not? And why is thy heart grieved? Am I not better to thee than 10 sons? I think Elkanah was stricken with a masculine problem. He sort of thought he was the best gift that the world had gotten, at least that Hannah had gotten. But he was trying to comfort her. He was trying to figure out what he can do for her. And of course, she apparently got up, after they had eaten in Shiloh and had drunk, it says that Eli the priest sat up on a seat by the post of the temple of the Lord. And she was in bitterness. And then Hannah began to pray. And she vowed a vow. And I have to admit that here is where I think somewhere Hannah's ability, Hannah's love for her God was deeper yet than the attachment she would have to a child. Because listen what she says. O Lord of hosts, if thou wilt indeed look upon the affliction of thine handmaid and remember me and not forget thine handmaid, but wilt give unto thine handmaid a man-child, then I will give him unto the Lord all the days of his life, and there shall no razor come up on his head. And as you know, the rest of the story, Eli accused her of being drunk, and then when he understood that no Hannah indeed was praying, he said, go in peace, and the God of Israel grant thee thy petition that thou hast asked of him. And she said, let thine handmaid find grace in thy sight. So the woman went her way and did eat, and her countenance was no more sad. And she had an appetite then after that, the way it looks, because she ate and she was no more sad. The story, as we know, Hannah and Elkanah went home, and the Lord blessed her with a child. She named him Samuel. And here is part of why this is such story stands out so much, is that we were talking about the care that mothers have for their children. But I wanted to end up with this example because this superseded her wanting to serve God, superseded her care for her child. When you look at the fact that she then stayed at home for, we're assuming 3, 4, 5 years, we don't know for sure, the Bible doesn't say exactly, but as long as he wasn't weaned, she stayed at home. But when she did then go to Shiloh, she took him up with her with 3 bullocks and 1 ephah of flour and a bottle of wine and brought them to the house of Shiloh. And the child was young, it says. I don't know how old, it doesn't say. And she said to Eli, and they slew a bullock and brought the child to Eli. And she said, O my Lord, as thy soul liveth, my Lord, I am the woman that stood by thee here praying unto the Lord. For this child I prayed, and the Lord hath given me my petition, which I asked of him. Therefore also I have lent him to the Lord as long as he liveth. He shall be lent unto the Lord, and he worshipped the Lord there. I don't know. I'm a father, but I'd have a hard time leaving a 3 or 4 year old child with a stranger, and giving him up. But Hannah's love for God was even deeper, it seems to me, than her love for her son. And I would like to just read. I'd like to beg about 5 more minutes if I could, because I'd like to read Hannah's song. I'd like for you to note something about Hannah. And maybe a bit of background here. How do we worship God? How do we think about God when we worship him? Do we think about him for the things he gives us? Or do we think about him for who he is? I would just say that truly, we do praise God, and that is worship as well. But when I am truly in a worship mode, I am not thinking about all he gives me. I'm thinking about who he is. Now, listen to Hannah. She makes just a brief reference to something that she hints at what he does for the barren, but listen to what all she says about God. She says, "My heart," in verse 1 of chapter 2, "My heart rejoices in the Lord. Mine horn is exalted in the Lord. My mouth is enlarged over mine enemies, because I rejoice in thy salvation. There is none holy as the Lord, for there is none beside thee. Neither is there any rock like our God. Talk no more so exceeding proudly. Let not arrogance come out of thy mouth. For the Lord is a God of knowledge, and by him actions are weighed. The bows of the mighty men are broken, and they that stumbled are girded with strength. They that are full have hired out themselves for bread, and they that were hungry ceased. So that the barren hath borne 7, and she that hath many children is waxed feeble. The Lord killeth and maketh alive. He bringeth down to the grave. He bringeth up and bringeth up. The Lord maketh poor and maketh rich. He bringeth low and he lifteth up. He raiseth up the poor out of the dust. He lifteth up the beggar from the dunghill to set them among princes and to make them inherit the throne of glory. For the pillars of the earth are the Lord's, and he has set the world upon them. He will keep the feet of the saints, and the wicked shall be silent in darkness. For by strength shall no man prevail. The adversaries of the Lord shall be broken to pieces. Out of heaven shall he thunder upon them. The Lord shall judge the ends of the earth. He shall give strength unto the king and exalt the horn of the anointed." Obviously, Hannah was delighted with what God had given her. But like I say, she made a brief reference to what he does for the barren, but that was not the thing that was captivating her attention. And I would just say this, that the best way that we can care for those who God gives us is to worship God for what he wants to do and what he can do in the lives of our children. I remember hearing a speaker he said 3 things. He said, when it comes to children and what we would like to see, how we care for our children, he said, 1, God cares more. And God knows more. And God can do more. I rest in that. I've come back to that many times, to honor God for who he is. May I read to you yet from Psalm 31? And I'm paraphrasing a bit. In verse 10, "Who can find a virtuous woman? For her price is far above rubies. The heart of her husband doth safely trust in her, so that he shall have no need of spoil. She will do him good and not evil all the days of her life. She rises early and makes breakfast for her husband before he goes to work, and for her children before they go to school. She plans and cooks three meals a day. She washes dishes. She launders clothes. She irons and folds them without complaining. She plants a garden and harvests the produce to feed her family. She preserves food so that the family has food in the winter. She prays often for her family. She reads her Bible to maintain a relationship with her Maker. She kisses the wound of the little one. She tailors and mends the clothes of her family. Verse 25, strength and honor are her clothing, and she shall rejoice in time to come. She openeth her mouth with wisdom, and her tongue is the law of kindness. She looketh well into the ways of her household, and eateth not the bread of idleness. Her children arise up and call her blessed. Her husband also, and he praises her. Many daughters have done virtuously, but thou excellest them all. Favor is deceitful and beauty is vain, but a woman that feareth the Lord, she shall be praised. Give her of the fruit of her hands, and let her own works praise her in the gates. Today is a day when we as husbands and children can give honor to our mothers. Let's kneel and pray. Father in heaven, we are grateful that you have provided so amply for us as your children, as humans. You have given us mothers. You have given us not just mothers who bear children, but mothers who may not bear children, but who care. And I just pray a special blessing on the women in this church, and pray that you will give them a sense of value, a deep sense of importance, and give them grace as they fulfill the duties that you call them to, regardless whether it's in their home, at work, or wherever it is. May you use them for your glory, and may we honor them for who they are and for what they do for us. Thank you again for caring for each one of us. May we be faithful. May we serve you with integrity and with joyfulness. In Jesus' name, amen.